Mr. Sela Sosa, since he's been shot by ICE agents?
Well, he's not my client. I represent Mr. El Horna, but I understand all of the, in this case, Mr. El Horna, Mr. Sosa Celis, they're all back home with their families.
That's Mr. Sosa Celis. Thanks so much for being with us. Frederick Goetz, criminal defense attorney who represents Alfredo Alejandro El Horna, one of the two Venezuelan men who were falsely accused of assaulting a federal immigration agent in Minneapolis in January. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Neil Shabata. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the historic Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Mossab Abu-Toha, the Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa, the singer and songwriter Michael Stipe, the jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, the formerly known as Eve Ensler, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and so many more. Juan Gonzalez will be flying in from Chicago, joining me and Nermeen Sheikh and our whole Democracy Now! Family for the celebration. Check out democracynow.org for information and tickets. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, civil rights icon, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, passes away. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield sued the Department of Homeland Security again. And the Oregon legislature scrambles to create legislation to protect immigrants. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 17, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, a contemporary and friend of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and two-time presidential candidate, died early Tuesday. Reverend Jackson led the civil rights movement for decades following the assassination of Dr. King in Memphis, Tennessee. As a young political organizer in Chicago, Reverend Jackson was called to meet with King at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis shortly before King was killed. Jackson publicly poised himself as King's successor and the new leader of the civil rights movement. Santita Jackson confirmed her father, who suffered from a rare neurological disorder, died at home in Chicago, surrounded by family. Ms. Jackson went on to say, quote, "Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world. We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became part of our extended family," end quote. Jackson was born in Greenville, South Carolina, on October 8, 1941. He led a lifetime of crusades in the United States and abroad, advocating for the poor and underrepresented on issues from voting rights and job opportunities to education and health care. He scored diplomatic victories with world leaders, and through his Rainbow Push Coalition, he channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. When Jackson declared, quote, "I am somebody," in a poem he often repeated, he sought to reach people of color. It was a message he took literally and personally, having risen from obscurity in the segregated South to become America's best-known civil rights activist since King. In his final months, as he received 24-hour care, he lost his ability to speak, communicating with his family and visitors by holding their hands and squeezing. His son, Jesse Jackson Jr., said, quote, "I get very emotional knowing that these speeches belong to the ages now," end quote. Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson was 84. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield is working with a group of protesters and journalists to strengthen their case against the Department of Homeland Security. Rayfield's office submitted supporting evidence and legal arguments in a class action lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Oregon on behalf of protesters and media. The lawsuit alleges federal agents used excessive force and violated the First Amendment rights of people demonstrating and recording at the ICE facility in Portland. A judge issued a temporary restraining order in the lawsuit roughly 2 weeks ago, heavily restricting the use of tear gas by federal agents. That TRO expires today, so Rayfield wants the courts to keep those restrictions in place. Rayfield says the evidence submitted by his office shows federal agents repeatedly deploying tear gas on a densely packed crowd of peaceful anti-ICE protesters the weekend of January 31st. The lawsuit alleges each plaintiff has been subjected to extreme force by federal agents while trying to protest injustice. It also says that under DHS Secretary Kristi Noem and President Donald Trump, federal agents have repeatedly met these demonstrations with excessive shows of force. Rayfield said, quote, "Oregonians from all walks of life, parents, children, teachers, healthcare providers, members of the legal profession, and countless others have been subject to tear gas, pepper balls, and flashbangs without regard for the bedrock constitutional principles that constrain all law enforcement." He went on to say, "Simply put, in a betrayal of the public's trust, federal agents have punished Oregonians for exercising their rights of assembly and expression," end quote. Kelly Simon, legal director of the Oregon ACLU, told the Mercury, quote, "This is an incredibly important decision. Our ability to exercise our rights nationwide is more important than ever, especially as this nation, as Judge Simon says, faces a crossroads. People need to be able to organize and speak out in ways that seek to build power," end quote. The Department of Homeland Security's account of two Venezuelans shot in Portland by Border Patrol agents fell apart in court. Federal immigration officials said their agents shot two vicious gang members in Portland who had attempted to run over officers with their vehicle. However, in records released to The Guardian, a U.S. prosecutor has contradicted ICE's claims. In the official DHS press release and social media posts, Border Patrol agents conducted a targeted stop of a vehicle in southeast Portland occupied by two members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. DHS reports continue that during the Border Patrol stop, the driver, Luis Nino Moncada, weaponized their vehicle against officers. Consequently, an officer defended himself and others by shooting the occupants. DHS also attempts to tie passenger Yorlenis Zambrano Contreras to another shooting in Portland last year. Both occupants of the truck were hospitalized, then taken into federal custody. The agents were uninjured. Court records reveal a Department of Justice prosecutor lately directly contradicted DHS Tren de Aragua comments in court, telling the judge, quote, "We're not suggesting the occupants are gang members," end quote. Portland City Councilor Samir Canal said, quote, "The federal government cannot be trusted. Our default position should be skepticism and understanding they lie very regularly. There's a playbook of demonizing people and claiming vehicles were used as weapons. We see a pattern of victim blaming, and it's important we push back because it's propaganda," end quote. Immigration and criminal justice experts who reviewed the case records characterized the federal government's communications as a smear campaign against the two Venezuelan immigrants, with mischaracterizations of their pasts and unsubstantiated allegations of criminality. None of the six Border Patrol agents involved in the Portland shooting recorded body camera footage. The shooting occurred in a hospital parking lot. However, the FBI said in an affidavit supporting the charges that surveillance cameras didn't capture the incident. Without video documentation, the charging documentation largely relies on agent testimony. The U.S. Attorney's Office will face significant hurdles in prosecuting Nino Moncada if the case goes to trial. The government has to prove he had the intent to assault the agents with the vehicle, which will be challenging without body camera evidence and the DHS's admission no agents were injured. The claims of Nino Moncada's gang connections and loose ties to a previous shooting could be considered unduly prejudicial and excluded from trial. Salem lawmakers are moving quickly this week on a new package of bills aimed to create a shield for Oregon's immigrant and refugee families. This comes as federal immigration enforcement has increased statewide. One major proposal, House Bill 4138, focuses on law enforcement transparency. It bans officers from wearing masks to hide their faces. Supporters argue that requiring officers to show their faces is a simple way to build trust and accountability between federal agents and the people they serve. Another bill, House Bill 4079, is focused specifically on local schools. It would require schools to tell parents immediately if ICE agents are on campus. In the Oregon Senate, lawmakers are debating whether hospitals should be sanctuary spaces by proposing Senate Bill 1570. This bill would limit when federal agents can enter medical facilities. Not everyone is on board with the new rules, though. Some hospital leaders worry the state is overstepping its legal authority. They argue that blocking federal agents could lead to complicated legal battles. Meanwhile, community groups, including SEIU 503 and the ACLU of Oregon, are asking for $10 million in state aid to pay for the lawyers and emergency rent for families in crisis. The legislative session is a short session, meaning time is running out. Most of these bills must pass their first major vote by the end of next week. Oregon's first black woman senator, Avil Gordley, passed away Monday of natural causes. Gordley, who served Oregonians in a noteworthy public service career, sought to improve police accountability, mental health treatment, and the lives of the disadvantaged before, during, and after her 17 years in the Oregon legislature. Gordley was born February 13, 1947, to Faye Gordley and Beatrice Bernice Coleman Gordley, and was delivered at Emmanuel Hospital by Dr. Denorville Unthank, one of Oregon's first black physicians. She grew up with two siblings in the historic Albina district in a home later purchased by the city of Portland and turned into Gordley Birch Center for Black Leadership and Civic Engagement. Gordley said she grew up learning from examples of the strong women around her, including her mom and grandmothers, who were active in social clubs and always working to elevate others. Gordley internalized their lessons, calling it lifting as we climb. Gordley, a Portland Democrat, once commented to then House Speaker Karen Minnis, a Wood Village Republican, that the state Capitol building was full of white pioneers, not black people whom state leaders at the time worked to exclude at Oregon's founding. Gordley, who is often described as the conscience of the legislature, mentioned to Minnis the importance of the legislation that prohibited Jim Crow segregation in restaurants, theaters, and other public places. Their conversation in 2005 ended with the acknowledgement of a photograph in the Capitol of then State Representative Mark Hatfield and NAACP supporters at the bill signing. Minnis, moved by Gordley's message, replaced that photo with Gordley's help outside the entrance to the Oregon House of Representatives chamber. After leaving the legislature, Gordley's career turned full circle, returning to her alma mater, Portland State University, as a professor in the school's Black Studies program, where she taught until 2012. Avil Gordley was 79. Congress doesn't have a clear path forward to end the DHS funding fight. Hospitalized ICE detainees aren't being allowed to privately speak with family and attorneys, and Kentucky colleges worry about potential immigration enforcement. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We were all set to pass this bill, and then Democrats reneged on the agreement. And so, here we are. Circumstances changed. I understand that. But some Democrats were already signaling they were prepared to walk away from the deal before the most recent events in Minneapolis.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune is blaming Democrats for the shutdown of the Homeland Security Department. He says just before ICE officers killed two people in Minneapolis, a bipartisan deal had been worked out, including more body cameras, greater transparency on ICE spending, and de-escalation training for officers. That budget deal also allocated millions more for immigration enforcement and for detention centers. ICE's budget was tripled in last year's Republican budget megabill, meaning the current shutdown doesn't impact the agency, but it pauses funding for the Coast Guard, TSA, and FEMA. Democrats are calling for limits on immigration officers. Some Republicans argue ending the Minnesota operation should be enough, but it was during a Chicago sweep when agents shot Miramar Martinez five times and joked about it. A federal judge just ruled DHS had lied to justify that shooting, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the reforms have to be written into law to, quote, halt ICE abuses.
Otherwise, what Tom Homan says today could be reversed by Donald Trump on a whim tomorrow. Without legislation, Donald Trump could choose to put a rogue force in any city he wants and have them operate without guardrails at all.
Immigrant rights groups say Democrats' reforms to ICE to follow standard police rules aren't enough, calling for an end to cooperation agreements between DHS and local law enforcement. And they're demanding investigations into migrant detention centers where more than 50 people have died since President Donald Trump returned to office. They say ICE agents are sometimes preventing hospitalized detainees from speaking privately with attorneys or family members. Attorney Shuming Cheer with the California Immigrant Policy Center says lawyers and family members have to know enough to tell doctors about the patient's health conditions and medications.
The lack of visitation and lack of information add to the heightened stress, and it's really critical for people in that situation to have contact with their attorneys so they know what their rights are.
Though immigration violations are civil issues like lawsuits and building violations, migrants are regularly being put in regular criminal jails where correction officers control their access to all medical care. Although the administration seems to be signaling a softening in its aggressive immigration policy, many states are fearful they could be the next Minnesota. Data show Kentucky's community college system has more than 30,000 first and second generation migrant students, along with 20,000 international students. There haven't been any documented ICE raids on state community college campuses, but Katie Varner with American Federation of Teachers there says school staff are bracing themselves.
Faculty in general feel under threat right now. People are walking into classrooms, turning on their cell phones, recording what teachers say in the hopes that they can somehow get these folks fired.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather, the snow level dips down to about 500 feet. Expect overnight clouds and light winds with a low near 30. Tomorrow, a winter weather advisory is in effect for higher elevations. Expect a chance of showers with an afternoon high near 40 degrees. Today in history, the U.S. women's Olympic hockey team defeated Canada 3-1 to win their first gold medal in the first ever women's Olympic hockey tournament. The quote of the day is from the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who said, quote, "I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody." With continued indiscriminate immigration enforcement actions across the country, Indigenous and First Nations people are increasingly concerned that they are stereotyped and targeted by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Consequently, many have been detained. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As immigration enforcement actions continue across the country, Indigenous people are increasingly concerned they're being targeted by ICE, and some have been detained. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Daniel Spalding has more.
On the morning of December 5th, Shailene Allen received a panicked phone call from Jose Joaquin Sanchez Alvarado, the father of her children. Alvarado was driving from his home in Meridian, Idaho to pick up their 10-year-old son to take him to school. Suddenly, he was surrounded by police.
He called me from inside the car and he's like, I think they're taking me. And he was just like, I'm pretty sure they're detaining me.
Allen is a member of the Shoshone Paiute tribe in Idaho and Nevada. Alvarado, who is undocumented and not a tribal member, came to the United States from Mexico when he was just 11 years old.
He doesn't have a criminal record. I don't even know why they're really targeting him.
Alvarado is now being held in an ICE detention facility near Las Vegas. As ICE ramps up operations across the country, that fear is widespread in Native communities. Despite being U.S. citizens and members of sovereign tribal nations, indigenous people are increasingly being questioned and in some cases detained by immigration agents. In January, Peter Yazzie, an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation, was detained by ICE in Phoenix before being released later that day.
We are the first people of this country, and our citizenship should never be questioned or challenged by anyone.
That's Crystalline Curley, the speaker of the Navajo Nation Council. In January, the council passed legislation calling on ICE to formally recognize Navajo Nation identification documents. Many tribes across the country are urging their citizens to carry tribal IDs at all times. In January, the Native American Rights Fund, or NARF, hosted a Know Your Rights webinar. Over 1,000 people attended. Beth Wright is a senior staff attorney at NARF and a member of the Pueblo of Laguna.
I think there's a lot of concern about what to do if tribal citizens are stopped by ICE and what their rights are in different encounters with ICE. I think one of the important messages to convey is that tribal citizens are citizens of the United States.
But many Native parents are worried that their tribal IDs won't be enough. Eva Flores is a member of the Pascua-Yaqui tribe in Arizona. She lives in Caldwell, Idaho.
You know, I fear for my kids to go out, even just to school or activities, not knowing if, you know, they're coming home or they're going to be picked up.
In a statement, the Department of Homeland Security said its agents are trained to determine a person's immigration status and whether they are subject to removal. As tribal leaders call on federal authorities to respect tribal sovereignty, parents like Shailene Allen are focused on protecting their children.
We don't need ICE on our street. They're only terrorizing brown people, and it's not doing any good. They're violating constitutional rights. They're killing people.
I'm Daniel Spaulding.
The annual Indigenous Hoop Dancing Championships were held over the weekend, returning to the Heard Museum in Phoenix. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the reigning title holder made history by defending his crown once more.
A two-point difference, 214 points, Josiah Enriquez.
The three-peat adult division champ, who is Navajoan from the pueblos of Isleta and Powaki in New Mexico, made history Sunday night. His victory marks a very rare feat no one else has achieved, except the sport's most decorated dancer 3 decades ago. Arizona's Derek Suwaima Davis, who is Hopi and Choctaw, won 3 of his record-setting 7 world titles in a row between 1996 and 1998. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. now experiences a billion-dollar disaster about every 2 weeks on average. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The wildfires in Los Angeles last year killed more than 24 people and caused about $60 billion in damage. They were the costliest U.S. wildfires on record. And expensive disasters like fires, hurricanes, and storms have become more common, even after adjusting for inflation.
The frequency of these billion-dollar disasters has changed from about once every 82 days to once every roughly 2 weeks over the last 10 years.
Adam Smith at the nonprofit Climate Central runs the U.S. billion-dollar weather and climate disasters database, which tracks disaster costs. The federal government ran this database until last year when the Trump administration cut the program. But businesses, researchers, and public officials rely on this data, so Climate Central picked up where the government left off. Smith says disaster costs are rising because people are building in disaster-prone places, many areas have inadequate building codes, and extreme weather is getting worse.
human-caused climate change is supercharging the intensity and the frequency of some of these extremes that lead to billion-dollar disasters.
And the coming years will likely bring even more costly disasters.
So this data we're providing is increasingly important as we plan for the future.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
We now go to Global Citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everybody. Six Republicans joined Democrats in the House last week in voting to end President Trump's 25% tariffs on most Canadian imports. The vote could be the start of several more congressional challenges to his trade policies. Trump threatened to retaliate against the six Republicans. The measure is largely symbolic, since Trump will probably veto the resolution if it clears the Senate. But the resolution points to a serious political problem for Trump. Tariffs continue to be strongly opposed by the voting public. 60% disapprove of Trump's increased tariffs, while 37% say they approve, according to a February survey by the Pew Research Center. Manufacturing, which tariffs are supposed to encourage to stay in America, now employs 313,000 fewer workers than it did 3 years ago. Since last April, when Trump declared a national emergency over the trade deficit and imposed his historic import taxes, 72,000 factory positions have vanished. Who pays for the tariffs? The administration insists, in defiance of well-established economics, that importers pay. The experts strongly disagree. Higher tariffs directly increase the cost of imported goods, raising prices for U.S. consumers and businesses, says the Congressional Budget Office. Americans are paying 95% of the tariffs, while foreign companies swallow the remainder. A December study by economists at Harvard University and the University of Chicago likewise concluded that 94% of the tariffs imposed last year were passed on to U.S. importers. A report by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York last week also concluded that 90% of the tariffs are paid for by American consumers and companies. Importers pay in another way that is less noted: U.S. customs bonds, a form of insurance which importers must pay to receive their cargo. CNBC reports that, quote, for fiscal 2025, U.S. Customs has identified 27,479 customs bond insufficiencies, valued at nearly $3.6 billion, double the 2019 level when insufficiencies first soared due to Trump's first-term trade policies. What this means is that while the U.S. government is taking in record revenue from tariffs, many importers are suffering, unable to cover their incoming products with the customs bonds. The public's negative view of tariffs meshes with its overall pessimism about the economy, signaling deep trouble for Trump and the Republicans. The latest CNN poll indicates that by 61% to 39%, the public disapproves of Trump's economic policies. On tariffs, the split is nearly the same, 62% to 37%. Those polled also said by a large margin that the economy and the cost of living are the most important issues in the country, 42% compared with 22% who cite the state of U.S. democracy and 15% who say immigration is the most important issue. A December CBS YouGov survey found 63% of Americans oppose the U.S. placing new tariffs on goods from other countries, with 68% saying they drove up prices in 2025 and 59% saying they expect tariffs to drive up prices in 2026. An NBC report on several polls found similar results and noted how Trump world has turned against him on what was once one of his greatest strengths. Trump closed out his first term in 2020 with majorities approving of how he handled the economy. And he had double-digit advantages over Vice President Kamala Harris on the economy and the cost of living when he defeated her in 2024. During the first few months of Trump's current term, his approval rating on the economy hovered in the mid-40s, but it has since dropped several points. An Associated Press survey conducted January 8 through 11 found 37% of Americans approve of how Trump is handling the economy, while a Reuters Ipsos survey conducted January 12 to 13 found his economic approval rating at 34%, with 30% approving of his handling of inflation. Still more generally, an NBC News poll from late October found around two-thirds of registered voters said Trump and his administration had fallen short of their expectations on inflation and the cost of living, looking out for the middle class and the economy. Around one-third said Trump had lived up to their expectations on those issues. And an NBC News Decision Desk poll in late November and early December found that 44% of Americans, the largest share in the poll, said inflation and the cost of living are the economic issues that mattered most to them and their families. The next closest issue, at 13%, was health care costs. One interesting economic matter that is not being polled is what people think about the widening gap between the super rich and everyone else. MS Now notes that 1% of Americans now own around one-third of all wealth in the country. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 17, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nina Mayfair, Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
Making contact.
We need in every community a group